You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Later this hour, we reconvene the triple play. We've done our grieving over the Dodgers. It's now time to look at the opening of the World Series tonight. So Nick Roman, A. Martinez will be joining yours truly. We'll talk about the World Series. But right now, we focus on the complexities of healthcare. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democratic presidential candidate, was pressed at the most recent debate by both moderators and other candidates on how she planned to pay for her Medicare for All plan.
The way I see this, it is about what kinds of costs middle-class families are going to face. So let me be clear on this. Costs will go up for the wealthy, they will go up for big corporations, and for middle-class families, they will go down. I will not sign a bill into law that does not lower costs for middle-class families.
The senator has said she is soon to release a plan that describes how she would fund her Medicare for All plan. With us to talk about how this is factoring into the senator's campaign is Bloomberg reporter who's covering Elizabeth Warren. In fact, she's in Waterloo, Iowa, where the senator is getting set to make an appearance. We're joined by Ms. Elena Egolfopoulou. Thank you very much for joining us. Share with us how this has been playing out on the campaign trail among the senator's supporters.
Hi. So great to join you here from Iowa. Like you mentioned, this was a question that Senator Warren was asked during the debate. But this wasn't the first time she's been asked this question. I've been with her on the campaign trail for the past few months, and we've constantly been asking her what she's going to do about affording a universal health care plan. And the answer to that is her campaign has not yet figured out how to pay for it. So we're seeing a candidate that's basically come out with a pay for every other plan that she's put forth. But for the most important plan, which is Medicare for All, she hasn't necessarily come out and said, this is exactly how I'm going to pay for it. Now, when we talk to Senator Warren about it, she says that there are several different revenue streams from which Medicare for All can be funded, and the cost of it could vary by trillions. And so she's saying her campaign has been working on figuring out the details for this plan for months now. And you heard it in the voice recording from the debate earlier that you played. She's vowing that middle-class families won't be paying more under Medicare for All, and the wealthy and the rich corporations are going to be the ones to be carrying the weight of the cost. But what's interesting here is the fact that she's already enforcing a wealth tax, which is supposed to raise some $2.7 trillion over the course of 10 years. And with that tax, she's somewhat exhausted some of the pressure she can put on costs on the wealthy and the corporations, which is what basically raises this question of, what other revenue streams are there available for her to pay for this very, very expensive plan? Some estimates say it might cost about $30 trillion over the course of 10 years. And so this is a question that's been asked of her multiple times. And finally, this week, it was actually on Monday, we were in Iowa, and she announced that in the coming weeks, she'll be releasing a plan with the cost of her Medicare for All plan and the revenue streams for which she's going to be able to fund it.
Ms. Elena, what have her campaign officials been saying about the reason they haven't released it? Is it just simply politically they don't want it to be a target to be picked apart? Or is it that they're really having trouble figuring out how to describe this in a way that's going to be saleable?
That's a great question. I mean, look, I think what's really important to note is that even Bernie Sanders, who sort of gave birth to this entire notion of Medicare for All, he introduced this bill in 2017. And when he did that, he did not attach a sort of pay for that bill. The Bernie Sanders campaign actually came out in September So about a month ago, with their plan of how they were going to fund Medicare for All, sort of using partially a wealth tax to raise the money needed to cover everyone with universal health care. And so it isn't necessarily out of character not to have released exactly how you're going to pay for this plan. And but for the Warren campaign, it's somewhat different because she set herself really high standards when it comes to how she's going to finance every single other one of her plans. And so her supporters expected the sort of same response to the Medicare for All plan. Her campaign is saying that it's a very complicated plan and that there are several revenue streams from which it can come from and that there are trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in sort of difference in cost that they can come up with. And so they're saying they're talking to people, to economists, to healthcare experts, to come up with a plan that they have promised will not raise the cost for middle-class families. And just to add something to this, I was speaking to Emmanuel Saez, the UC Berkeley economist who came up with, who helped Senator Warren develop her wealth tax just a week ago on this issue. And what he told us was that, you know, her promise isn't necessarily far off. If there are no healthcare premiums from private health insurance, which Senator Warren has vowed she will abolish, that could mean that middle class families, will be paying lower costs. But Senator Warren will not be using the word tax at all to sort of describe the cost of healthcare. And that's something that we're going to be looking at because she's promising not to use that word. And so, you know, we're wondering how long she can sort of keep that up for.
All right. Ms. Elena, thank you so much for reporting for us from the campaign trail where you're in Waterloo, Iowa, where Senator Warren is going to be speaking to her supporters very shortly. We appreciate your joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's Ms. Elena Egolfopoulou of Bloomberg News. Also joining us from the University of Pennsylvania School of Law, Professor Allison Hoffman. She's a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics at Penn. She's also co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. Professor Hoffman, we appreciate your being with us. And I know that you're strongly in support of this. You believe that it would close a lot of the holes that exist in the American healthcare system currently under private insurance. What do you see as the potential areas where revenue could be raised to pay for this?
So that just to start off, when you think about what Elizabeth Warren has been doing so far, she's laid out her vision. And you know, that's not an unreasonable place to start. And that vision includes both what she wants to do, which is universal coverage and coverage that's quite comprehensive. If she's piggybacking on Bernie's plan, way more comprehensive than what Americans have today. And then she's also said, I'm going to finance it without increasing taxes for middle class Americans. And so that gives us some guidelines on what she wants to do. And then there are the details. So once you decide what's covered, what the benefits are, how to finance it is in some ways an accounting question. So if you look at the estimates of how much it will cost, the estimates tell us about 10 years from now, our total spending on healthcare as a country will be about the same with more people and more services covered. What will be different is that the way to finance it will come solely from the federal government, whereas today we use many different sources. We use things like taxes and employers pay for part of it. And so if you could take all the dollars we pay today through all of these sources and put them in a federal pool of money, it would almost it would either pay completely for the total spending or would almost pay for the total spending. But the hard part is that accounting problem. How do you get the dollars into the
And figuring out who pays more and who pays less, because you know, one of the points that she's raised is that this would be a benefit to the middle class insured person. But the problem is that, you know, she identifies the problem where there's this small percentage of people that get socked with these massive health care bills that in some cases are major contributors in bankruptcy filings. You're trying to figure out, well, how do you deal with those very high costs that people are bearing? But if you put that on to essentially middle class people who are generally healthy, not paying those bills, how do you do that in a way that their taxes don't appreciably increase?
Right. So that's the hard part. So right now, an average family of four spends about $28,000 a year on health care. And some of that they spend because they pay for premiums every month and they pay for health care every time they go to the doctor. And some of that they spend because their employers are paying money for their health insurance that they're not paying in salary dollars. And so when Elizabeth Warren talks about the research that she's done on bankruptcy and how American households are struggling under these costs, she's talking about the slice of that, the piece of that, which is, I think, about $8,000 a year on average for the average non-elderly family that they have to deal with out of pocket. But the total cost to American families today is much larger than that. And so the question is, if we shift the way we pay for health care, it's a chance to redefine, you know, who pays. And so she may see this new policy as a way to make financing health care less regressive, so higher earners might pay more and lower earners would pay less.
We're talking with University of Pennsylvania Professor of Law Allison Hoffman. Coming up, we'll talk with Joe Antos, who's a health policy expert and economist with the American Enterprise Institute. We'll continue the conversation. It's Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. One of the triplets just entered the house. Nick Roman is here to talk baseball for the World Series. A. Martinez will be coming in with headphones dangling. Always, A has just finished with an interview for Take Two. He'll be joining us shortly. We'll preview the World Series coming up. But right now, we are attempting to preview the potential ways of paying for Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan. Her team says that she'll have that the full proposal with the funding mechanism out shortly. We've been talking with Penn's Allison Hoffman, where she's a law professor, as well as senior fellow at the Institute of Health Economics at Penn. Also with us from the American Enterprise Institute, health policy expert and health economist, Joe Antos. Joe, it's good to have you with us again on Air Talk. So let's look at the potential ways of funding this. One of them that's talked about is a payroll tax. How would that work?
Thanks, Larry. if we leave aside the possibility that health reform proposal could actually improve the efficiency of the health system, if we just focus on financing the system that we have, or an expanded system that's likely to be more inefficient, then payroll taxes are definitely the way to go. The reason is pretty straightforward. If you're trying to do a wealth tax, people imagine that we would be taxing wealth of wealthy people, but a lot of that wealth is actually contained in pension plans that, in fact, middle-class people depend on when they retire. Taxing wealth is really, really a bad idea. There's also the problem of valuation. Wealthy people often have assets that are very hard to evaluate. What is the worth of a piece of art? You don't know until you've sold it. With income taxes, you have transactions. You know exactly where the money is going. You know exactly who is receiving the money. You can set your – we already have a system for income taxation. You can adjust marginal tax rates, however you want to do that. But in the end, we're talking about so much money that needs to be collected through some form of taxation that the middle class will not be able to escape.
And just real briefly, I know this is kind of a bigger theoretical issue, but if taxes are significantly increased on wealthier Americans, how does that hurt middle class Americans' 401ks?
Well, the issue has to do with where does the money come from when you retire and you have your money in investments, typically stocks or in some cases bonds. The basic problem is that if you put a tax on wealth, not wealthy people, but wealth, then the however the accounting value of whatever the accounting value of your wealth in that pension plan will also be taxed. Now, if you excluded that, then you don't truly have a wealth tax. You have a tax that is supposed to be aimed at rich people. Somehow you're going to distinguish between rich people and middle-class people who hold assets for retirement that could be quite considerable. It's very difficult to figure all of that out. But if you tax, if you try to only tax high-income people through income taxes, that's going to drive them away from the kind of investments that might propel the economy, that might discourage economic growth. These are people who are sophisticated. They can hide their money.
Okay. Let's move on because we have limited time, Joe. So Bernie Sanders has proposed a 7.5% payroll tax on employers that would fund his plan. He estimates that would raise nearly $4 trillion for a decade of a payroll tax like that. What, from your view, is the problem with that proposal?
Well, there's a real distributional problem. The lowest paid worker is going to pay a part of that tax just as much as the highest paid worker. And since all of the Democratic plans are really oriented towards redistributing income or wealth to lower income workers, if you simply apply a percentage tax on all employers, you're going to hit small employers with low wage workers, where that tax can really have an impact on employment and on wage growth. You're going to be hitting very large employers where that tax might not be so significant, but there's still going to be potentially a wage and employment effect. Taxes are inherently discourage economic growth. They discourage wage growth. They discourage employment growth.
Let me go back to Professor Allison Hoffman of Penn. One of the things that Senator Warren is proposing is that all services, medical services, would be fully covered under this plan. How would this be dealt with economically, with expected increases in usage? Because if people don't feel, the use of their health care coverage, how do you deal with the likelihood that total costs will rise per capita?
Well, things are going to be covered now that aren't. So things like, dental and vision and other things that are covered now aren't. But the estimates that I mentioned earlier that say that the total spending per year is going to be about the same or less than it is now includes those services and includes the assumption that people are going to use those services. So, as we're trying to predict estimates, it's based on the thought that people will have health insurance that they need and that they'll actually use it to get things that they need. And I wanted to make one point on the question of on taxing employers for part of this is that, Bernie's proposal is defined in a way that employers will actually pay less than they do today. So employers are already spending a large amount of money on healthcare benefits for their employees. And then the question going forward is if they're not doing that directly, should some of that money be recouped to pay for a Medicare for All plan? And I totally agree with what Joe Anto said, is that it could end up being a plan that taxes, the higher earning employee the same as the lower earning employee, depending on how the employer handles it. But what we're asking employers to do is actually less under Bernie's plan. That's what he's asking them to do, is less than what they do and what kind of today's system requires of them.
Professor, wouldn't there, though, be pressure put on employers to increase compensation because now people get health care typically as part of their package of compensation? So if they're not getting that from the employer, wouldn't there be pressures put on employers to increase wages?
Yes, and arguably they should. So if they're spending less in a future Medicare for All plan per employee on healthcare, then arguably it would be fair to ask them to take those additional compensation dollars and translate them into wages.
But you think that would be net neutral, that they'd end up essentially, employers would end up essentially back where they are now with providing healthcare?
Right. So that makes sense conceptually, right, is to ask them to at least be net neutral. Whether they actually do that is a much more complicated question that Larry Summers and others have studied. And it depends really on who the employer is, who the employees are, and who has the bargaining power between the two, among other kinds of complicated dynamics there.
Joe Antos, just real briefly, so do you think that it's possible employers could end up with it being a neutral expenditure for them?
It seems pretty unlikely. I don't think Congress will ever pass a law that directs employers with regard to how they spend some savings from their internal operations. Net neutral, I don't think so. Certainly not net neutral with regard to their employees. But one thing that we've left out here, and that is, how will doctors, hospitals, and other providers feel about moving from a system where much of their income is paid at a substantially higher rate than the government pays through Medicare? There's some redistribution going on there as well, and that redistribution can have a serious impact on access to services and outlook for innovation.
Well, we've already got a problem here in Southern California having enough primary care docs because of, in part at least, because of those reimbursements. So the reimbursements to doctors, though, wouldn't that have to go up, Professor Hoffman, for that very reason, because you wouldn't have higher reimbursements from private insurance to help, lessen the burden of people seeing Medicare patients?
So, and I mean, that's a hard question, is exactly what would you need to pay to get enough doctors and enough, hospitals to do business in a new world. But one thing that we do know is that the U.S. is an outlier on what it spends on healthcare, and we're an outlier more because we pay more for every doctor's visit, every, prescription drug, every service than any of our peer nations do, twice as much on average than they do. And so if you're thinking about, bringing us into line with our peer nations, it would demand paying less for some services. Now, that doesn't mean that primary care doctors should be paid more for the visits that they're having with every one of their patients across California. But it does mean that you'd have to think hard about places where we're paying more for items and services than we should be. I mean, some of those areas have been in the news a lot lately, like what we pay for prescription drugs and what we pay for some kind of technology. And so that would require scrutiny to think about the spaces where you can save money through reimbursement without the supply of doctors.
I want to thank you both very much. That's Professor Allison Hoffman, University of Pennsylvania School of Law, senior fellow at the Davis Institute of Health Economics at Penn, and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of U.S. Health Law. My thanks to Joe Antos at the American Enterprise Institute as well. It's the triple play as the World Series Game 1 in Houston gets underway tonight. The Astros will be hosting the National League's Washington Nationals, who defeated the Dodgers, of course, in a five-game series. The Nationals, the wild card, but make it all the way through after sweeping the St. Louis Cardinals, who had home field advantage in that best-of-seven series. The triple play is, of course, A. Martinez of Take Two, Nick Roman of KPCC's All Things Considered.
Wait, the Dodgers aren't in the World Series? Wait,
well,
what happened?
I hate to tell you this, A.
Because we only get together when the Dodgers are in the World Series.
That's what I thought, too.
Wait, this is part of the healing process, gentlemen. Baseball goes on. Even without the Dodgers. Nick, you were at a Jackie Robinson event last night?
Yeah, at the Crawford Family Forum, we did a Jackie Robinson event. It was we had a jazz concert. Bobby Bradford had composed
the great Bobby Bradford.
A piece, to honor Jackie Robinson. It came in sort of like four parts. And so we had that. And then we also had a panel of five. We had Kathy Robinson Young, who's Jackie's niece. We had Byron Motley, whose dad, Bob Motley, was an umpire in the Negro Leagues and could talk about how, the path for him as an umpire in the big leagues was blocked for many, many years. We also had Peter Dreyer from Occidental, who had written about Jackie's broader effect on the civil rights movement. Jackie used to have jazz concerts at his home in Stamford, Connecticut. He had a nice 6-acre area with a little hilly area. And some really great players had performed there. Dizzy Gillespie had been there. And
the thing about being an icon, everybody wants to come and perform at your place.
Raised money for Dr. King and for a lot of other causes. We also had Mark Langell, who is the sort of like the in-house historian for the Dodgers. He was there. At first, he wasn't supposed to be there because we thought they were going to be in the World Series and he was going to be busy.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But then his schedule cleared. And then Tommy Davis was there, too.
Wow.
A two-time batting champion.
Yeah.
And Tommy stuck around later on and took selfies with a lot of people, including me. I try not to be too much of a fanboy.
Yeah, hard not to with Tommy yeah. Davis. Well, it sounds like a wonderful event.
Well, he told some really terrific stories, too, about baseball and about, the stands at Vero Beach when Tommy first came up were still segregated back in those days.
Really?
Yeah, in the 60s. And that was because of the local laws in Florida.
Wow. It's just remarkable when you think of how the Dodgers became such a popular team with African-American fans because of Jackie Robinson in later years. Well, so let's point toward tonight's World Series. Not a huge surprise. The Astros, they're the favorite overall, that they came out of it beating the Yankees to get to the World Series. Do the Nationals have much of a chance?
No, I don't think they do at all. Do you remember 2007, the Colorado Rockies? They won 14 out of their last 15 games to sweep their way into the postseason. Then they wound up not losing a single game in the playoffs until they got to the Red Sox, who were waiting for them, who were clearly the best team in the league that year, and the Red Sox swept the Rockies, who didn't seem like they could lose. This reminds me of that. The Washington Nationals were dead in the water at one point in the season. All of a sudden, they started playing well, they got together, and got to the postseason. We all thought they would lose to the Dodgers.
Yeah.
We all thought that maybe the Cardinals. No, they got to the World Series, but now talent, pure unadulterated talent awaits them in the Astros, and this is where the run
and
ends.
And there's a huge gap between these two teams talent-wise.
Well, yeah, but this sort of reminds me of the 1969 World Series when the Mets played a very powerful Baltimore Orioles team, and the Mets had some pitchers, outstanding starting pitching.
Including a young Nolan Ryan.
And young Nolan Ryan, Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, and they just machined the Orioles that year, and they had a very good platoon system and a way to move their veteran players to face the right kind of pitcher. They had done that in the playoffs that year against the Braves, and they did it again against the Orioles, and it worked. So because the Nationals have essentially four really talented starters, two who are just, transcendent. Steven Strasburg, who is fabulous, pitching better than anyone except, say, Garrett Cole. And Max Scherzer, who's just a tough guy. I think they have a chance.
Their number four starter has been pitching well.
Well, yeah, Anibal Sanchez, held St. Louis hitless for well into the seventh inning. So that was remarkable. So if their pitchers, are as good as they have been so far, they've got a good shot. I'm not saying that they're going to win, but they're not going to get beat real bad, I don't think.
It was remarkable how Washington was able to navigate a combustible bullpen against the Dodgers and just sort of magically kept their starters going in and out to cover
them. Well, they cut the bullpen down to three guys that they could trust, which would be the lefty Sean Doolittle, former Dodger, former Angel also, only at least in spring training, Daniel Hudson, and then a kid named Ty Rainey, who's really throwing well. So, when you get into the playoffs, you kind of shorten up the roster and you can do those kind of things.
Yeah.
But they have pitched a lot, so that's a concern.
Well, the difference, though, is that the Dodgers decided not to make a lot of contact against national starters and national
relievers.
That's
a bad strategy, wasn't it?
Oh, it's a terrible strategy if you want to win some ball games. The Astros are a different animal altogether. They're a power-hitting team of contact hitters. Some teams are power teams. Some teams are contact teams. The Astros do both. They hit with power, but when the situation calls for it, they make contact and keep the offense moving around the bases. That is something the Nationals did not face with the Dodgers, did not face with the Cardinals. That is the biggest difference in terms of talent when it comes to those clubs.
Where would you peg this Houston team, just pure talent-wise, compared to some of the Red Sox of last year? Or where do they stand talent-wise?
I don't see really hardly any weaknesses on this team. They can do just about everything on a baseball. Maybe the bullpen. I might give the bullpen as their weakest point, but that's like saying that this redwood tree isn't tall enough. It's still pretty good. It's just maybe their lowest point that they have. But even, I don't see a single way that they lose this World Series. Maybe if they'd have faced the Dodgers, but the Nationals seems too Cinderella for me to keep the slipper on.
Greinke has been a little shaky,
sure,
hasn't he?
Sure. And that's the game that they probably use their Greinke bullpen
the
a little bit more.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So Greinke has not been, he's not the Greinke who pitched for the Dodgers a few years ago. And Justin Verlander, I just looked this up a couple minutes ago, I knew that he was giving up a lot of home runs this year. He's given up home runs at a rate slightly higher than Clayton Kershaw did. So there's a chance, you know. I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but there's a chance.
All right. So you think the Nationals have a chance here. How long do you think this series is likely to go? You sounds like you think it's going
five,
pretty quick.
I would say when I'm that sure of something, I say it's going to be over in three games. Not quite, because they have to play at least four. Five games. I say the Nationals definitely
three
win.
Games.
Yeah, I know. The Nationals win one at home because they're good enough to win one game at home. They're not going to get swept, but that's as far as it probably goes.
I'll go six.
All right. And what about the ball? Because, you know, they're people who say that the postseason ball is not the same as the regular season ball, which, you know, with weeks to go in the season, set the all-time season home run record.
Well, postseason pitching is not the same as regular season pitching either. I mean, you get these are the good guys. So nobody hits quite like they did, you know, in the regular season. You know, some of the pitching staffs out there. I mean, we're not playing this thing in Colorado. You know, that's not happening. You're not playing. You're not batting against the, you know, Miami Marlins. This is way different.
Yeah. Do you think the ball is perhaps different, eh? The players seem to think it is.
Yeah, and they're the ones that you'd listen to, right? They're the ones that are holding it all day long. We're not. We're watching it. Maybe we get a foul ball once in a while. It probably is a little bit different, but how much of a difference does it really matter at this point?
Would MLB, do you think, actually mess with the ball between the regular season and the post? That would seem to be a pretty risky thing.
I say let's make it a wiffle ball in the postseason. How about that? That would make things a lot more fun.
I mean, you're assuming that Major League Baseball like really thinks stuff out, and I'm not sure that that's the case.
It sure doesn't seem like it once you factor in the commissioner and the ownership of it. Gentlemen, we appreciate it as always, the triple play. So we'll plan to reconvene next time there's some news to report on the Dodgers or Angels, and at the very latest, at the start of spring training and pitchers and catchers reporting.
Let's book it.
We'll be ready.
All right, sounds good.
We'll all be honing up.
I was going to say, we'll start now. Hey, Martinez of Take Two, Nick Roman of KPCC's All Things Considered. Astro Goth writes on the AirTalk page, what I want to know is the mantle bobblehead solar powered, or do we have to smack him around from time to time? How you use the bobblehead is entirely your decision, Astro Goth. But no, it's not solar powered, but be grateful. It'd be flapping its mouth all the time if it was. Great to have you with us on AirTalk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're focused on high gasoline prices. Why is it when we go to other states and we look at the price of the pump, it's dramatically lower than what we pay here in California? Well, in fact, Governor Gavin Newsom wants the answer to that question as well, and yesterday wrote a letter to State Attorney General Javier Becerra asking him to look at what he calls a mystery surcharge incorporated in the price of gasoline in California. His letter includes the language of looking at the possibility of price fixing or other anti-competitive practices. The governor writes, simply stated, name brand gas retail outlets in California are charging more for a gallon of gas compared to their unbranded hypermart competitors. Goes on to say, based on the enclosed report from the California Energy Commission, I request that your office, State Attorney General, open an investigation into whether false advertising or price fixing are occurring and contributing to the mystery surcharge imposed on Californians. With us to talk about what's going into the price charged at the pump is a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, Professor of Business Administration and Public Policy, Severin Borenstein, who directs the Energy Institute at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Severin, it's good to have you with us. We appreciate it very much. You're so good at explaining what goes into it, but are even you scratching your head a bit at these high prices?
Oh, yeah. I've been scratching my head for 4 years now. California does have higher prices, in part due to higher taxes and our environmental fees. And that's easy to reckon. But since 2015, our prices have been even higher than that, by 20 to 30 cents on average, which amounts to $3 to $5 billion a year. that Californians are paying above what you could explain through taxes and higher fees.
And just to refresh our memory, the gas tax that went into effect, how much did that increase the cost per gallon?
That increased the cost by about 5.5 cents a gallon. And overall, California's taxes and fees are about 70 cents a gallon higher than the average in the rest of the country. So when you start looking at that differential, you got to immediately take that out because that's easily explained. But right now, California gas prices are about $1.60 higher than the rest of the country. So there is a big gap that is not explained. And even over the last year, they've averaged about 30 cents higher or 30 cents higher than the rest of the country above what you can explain by taxes and fees.
Now, we had, of course, the attacks on the Saudi Arabian oil facilities a few weeks ago. We get most of our crude comes from Saudi Arabia, as I understand it, that's refined here. I should say it's not most, but the largest source, single source, is Saudi Arabia. Severin, could that have an effect?
It could have a very small effect, but if you look at the price of crude oil since that attack, it's actually lower right now than it was before the attack. So that is really not explaining the differential we have right now. And you also sometimes hear explanations like labor costs are higher and rents are higher in California. And those are true, but those were true from 2000 to 2014. And during that time, our gas prices were higher by just the differential in taxes and fees. Something since then has changed.
Severin, how susceptible are gas prices to supply and demand? In other words, if gasoline suppliers were to increase the costs in other parts of the country up to, say, what California pays, do they have a sense of what the decline in gallons sold would be?
Well, there would be some decline, but the main thing that is keeping gas prices from going up in the rest of the country is not their fear of selling less, but competition between the sellers. That's what keeps prices at reasonable levels. In California, there seems to have been some sort of reduction in competition that has kept prices higher, but we're not sure exactly where that is or whether it's actually just an increase in cost that hasn't been accounted for. And that's what I think the Attorney General's office has the resources and the investigative authority to actually dig into. And I'm hoping they're going to be able to come up with some crisp conclusions.
We're talking with Professor Severin Bornstein, UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, where he directs the Energy Institute. He's also professor at Cal. Joining us as well, the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, which has apps and websites giving real-time fuel prices at gasoline stations across the U.S. Patrick DeHaan, good to have you with us again. Appreciate it very much. What do you think is the effect of higher prices on sales of gas? Is it highly sensitive?
Well, is it highly sensitive? Not so much. Gasoline demand is very inelastic. That is, if prices, as we saw, go up by 60 cents a gallon overnight, there is no immediate replacement for gasoline. That is, your vehicle doesn't just magically change into an electric vehicle overnight. So there are still motorists that have internal combustion engines that really don't have an alternative besides getting in their car and driving to work. So there is a small measure of change when prices do skyrocket, small behavioral changes, but overall we remain reliant on gasoline, whether it's $2, $3, or $4, and sky-high prices will not necessarily quickly derail demand, and that's part of the reason why we generally see gas prices in California go up so quickly, is that economics would explain that when you have such an inelastic commodity, in this case gasoline, that prices are going to go up in search for a demand curve that begins to slip.
Severin, I had assumed that one of the reasons so many people are using public transit in California is that, you know, many more people have bought cars. We've seen that in the sales figures, congestion all over the state, and that much of that was fueled by, you know, going back a couple years or so, comparatively low historic gasoline prices. How much of a factor do you think that was?
Yeah, I think Patrick's right that in the short run, you don't see much response. In the longer run, you do see people change behavior by buying more fuel-efficient cars or possibly trying to live closer to where they work or take public transit more. But those take long periods of time, those sorts of adjustments. We do see them, and if we keep gas prices at very high levels, people will make those adjustments. But it doesn't happen overnight, and certainly it causes a lot of pain during the interim.
Patrick, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think that people still have a limited ability to respond. Often they simply can't afford to live near where they work because it's too expensive, so they live way out in the suburbs. And public transit doesn't give them an option.
Yeah, there's so many transfers to get between where they live and where they're going. Patrick DeHaan, what's your analysis of the high cost of California gas? What's going on?
Well, overall, there's kind of two functions to look at that it sounds like the governor may be touching on. First of all, the overall systemic problem of high prices in California. California, regardless of refinery issues or not, often is at the top of the list for highest average prices. Now, there's also the issue that the governor may have indirectly touched on, and that's that prices have surged in recent weeks. The two are separate issues. And certainly, to look at why California's prices are so much higher on a daily basis, regardless of refinery issues, you'd have to look into a lot of policy. That is, taxes that, according to the American Petroleum Institute, cost about 81 cents per gallon going to various federal, state, and local taxes. Of course, California has a cap-and-trade program that factors in as well. And then at the base of this, you have California, which the California Air Resources Board requires a unique blend of gasoline that is only utilized in the state of California. So that normally is not a problem when refineries are producing enough gasoline to meet demand. But very quickly, in the instance that we saw several weeks ago, when that does happen, when refineries do go down unexpectedly, as could happen with your car, it could just break down, then the foundation is there for prices to escalate very quickly because there is no immediate relief as a result of other refineries. There is a lack of interconnectedness with California refineries and the rest of the country. And you have this very stringent boutique gasoline that's required throughout the state that is oversought by the California Air Resources Board, not the EPA.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for being with us. That's Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, and Severin Bornstein, UC Berkeley professor and director of Cal's Energy Institute at the Haas School of Business. You can share your comments about high gasoline prices on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The repercussions of precautionary electricity shutdowns in Northern California continue. As you undoubtedly know, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, shut off power to what was close to a million people between Central and Northern California, that just a couple weeks ago, with historically high winds that had been forecast. But of course, the economic and just human cost of that has been very, very high. And there's a great deal of criticism of PG&E for over how they conducted those precautionary outages, not to mention the ongoing criticism that that privately run utility is not invested in making sure that its equipment was safe and wouldn't spark fires in the event of high winds. One of the proposals that's come out in the wake of this is for PG&E to move from private shareholder hands to that of either customer-owned or to municipally operated, like the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, or Pasadena, or Anaheim, which have their own municipal water and power companies. One of the proposals is coming from the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo. Mayor Liccardo, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, Larry. Good to be with you.
So what is the difference, first of all, between a customer-owned utility and a municipally-owned utility?
Well, from the standpoint of where we are and where we need to get to be municipalized, a city like San Jose would have to come up with billions of dollars to go buy the wires and poles currently owned by PG&E and essentially the entire distribution network, and obviously would bear the liability as well that any utility would bear for any fires or other kinds of events that obviously PG&E is bearing the brunt of. A customer-owned utility or a cooperative is actually not a novel notion. There are about 900 utility cooperatives in the country today. Most of them are pretty small. A couple of them are pretty large. But essentially, the customers would own the company, much as we see, for example, with mutual insurance company like USAA or Mutual of Omaha or a credit union. So the board would essentially be replaced by folks who represent the customers. And it would fair to say that the financial incentives and interests of the company would be much more aligned with the customers.
Now, the liabilities that PG&E faces, or down here in Southern California, SoCal Edison faces, they have the ability, in liability cases, to apportion the cost pending state PUC authorization, partly to shareholders and partly to their ratepayers. If you have a customer-owned model, wouldn't that put all of the burden then on your customers? You don't have any shareholders to share that with.
Yeah, I'm not a legal expert, so I'd be speaking out of school, but as I see it right now, PG&E has roughly $55 billion in liabilities. And I'm not sure there's much shareholder value left anyway. And for all intents and purposes, the liability and burdens of PG&E are really ultimately borne by customers and the public, the taxpayers. And we're seeing that in various forms, including obviously the most recent agreement that was struck in Sacramento. We know that going forward, PG&E is a struggling company. It's been in bankruptcy twice. There's a high probability, I would expect, that if a fund comes in, a hedge fund comes in and purchases the assets and obviously benefits from whatever positive value might be left with PG&E's carcass, there's probably going to be a third bankruptcy. And once again, it's all going to come down to ratepayers and taxpayers. And I think we all need to be honest with ourselves.
We're talking with the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo, who's proposing the co-op model, customer-owned utility or a municipal-owned utility. And he describes some of the differences there. Also with us is Michael Wara, who's director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. Thank you very much, Mr. Wara, for joining us. Your thoughts about either of these models versus the shareholder private model of SoCal Edison and PG&E?
Well, I think they have some pros in that, you know, customers and or local governments would have a greater degree of control over the company, and you would save money by not having to pay shareholders a profit on their investment. And maybe you could invest some of that money to, you know, increase safety, perhaps increase the innovativeness of the utility. On the other hand, I think it's important to remember that the utilities won't, the current owners of the utility won't give up without a fight. And the only way to make them give up without a fight is to pay them what they would consider to be a fair price for the assets. The history of trying to municipalize privately owned utilities in this country is one that is fraught with very extended litigation. The best example is the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, which took more than two decades to emerge after voters voted in favor of an initiative to municipalize PG&E's lines in that area.
In speaking of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, we're joined by the former CEO of that entity, currently president of the Large Public Power Council, John DeStasio. Thank you, sir, for being with us. You want to respond to what Michael Wara was just saying about the challenges in Sacramento?
No, that's correct. I think in Sacramento, we had the voters had voted to municipalize in, I think, 1923, and we didn't serve a single electron of electricity until 1947. So it can be a really protracted effort, especially when the private system is declared to not be for sale. Then that all needs to be done through significant regulatory and legal processes to ultimately get the people's will to be done.
Well, and I guess you're looking at other municipal-owned utilities. They're typically there from the beginning, right? Even as the cities incorporate, that's how they were able to do this in Los Angeles and elsewhere here in Southern California?
Yeah, there were opportunities very early on in the 30s for communities to make a determination about whether they would choose to municipalize or not, and many opted to. The large public power council, we have 27 large municipalities in 21 states, and those communities determined that the value of having direct accountability to consumers and transparency via public meetings, and also the alignment with regional or community priorities was of great importance to them. And I think that's the value proposition of public power.
Let me go back to Michael Wara and you know, talk about what ratepayers are paying here in California, because my understanding is that electricity rates per kilowatt hour are higher here than in other parts of the country. Why is that?
That's right. Electricity rates in California are among the highest in the country. Traditionally, the California Public Utility Commission and the Energy Commission have focused on investments in energy efficiency, so that even though the rate was high, like the cost per kilowatt hour, California homes and businesses would be more efficient, so that the total bill in any given month, which is what most people care about ultimately, would be lower. And so rates are high, but average electricity bills have historically been in the lower part of the lower 48 states. That's starting to change. Part of the change has to do with investments in gas infrastructure that have been required after San Bruno and modernization of our distribution system in the last few years. And then, of course, after 2017, there's been enormous investment due to the wildfires and attempts to reduce wildfire risk.
So that would be unique to California, but the repairing the infrastructure, updating that, that's across the country, right?
Well, to some degree, yes. To some degree, no. You know, it depends on what investments have been made over time, and to some degree, California has been investing in, you know, developing a kind of grid of the future. You know, we invested in smart meters for all of our customers. We've been investing in special systems in the distribution and transmission wires that allow better control, better management of distributed energy resources, things that are kind of consistent with the overall vision for 100% clean electricity in California. Some of that stuff costs money, and it's not always cheaper than the alternative, and so that's put some pressure on rates as well.
Okay.
Looking forward, you know, there's a big investment coming that has to do with wildfire, and
who's going to pay that? Yeah.
And that's going to happen no matter who owns the lines.
Sam Liccardo, mayor of San Jose, what would be the next step as you see it to investigate the potential for either a customer-owned co-op or city-owned, and you'd maybe join with other cities in joint ownership of a utility?
Yeah, I think, you know, we, at least in San Jose, prefer to push the customer-owned route. We're certainly recognizing the daunting challenges of municipalizing. And really, it's going to come down to both the federal bankruptcy judge and the CPUC. Under federal law, the PUC has to approve whatever comes out of bankruptcy, particularly if there's going to be a rate increase. And I guess just to build on Michael's last...
Real quickly, yeah.
The extraordinary amount of investment that's going to be required, not just to be resilient to wildfires, but to earthquakes and cyber attacks and all the other issues we're facing today, That's going to require access to capital.
All right. I need to break it off there. I'm so sorry. But Mayor Liccardo, thank you for joining us, Michael Rohr and John DeStasio as well. We appreciate your support so much for Air Talk on KPCC and the many ways that you provide it. You're part of the best and most generous audience in radio, and I certainly don't take you for granted. Thank you very, very much. We continue our conversation on municipal-owned or the alternative, a customer-owned co-op for utility companies. When does it make sense? When not? What's the difference in rates between one that's owned by shareholders as a private entity versus one that's owned either by its customers or by rate-paying public through city ownership of a utility, such as we have with Los Angeles Department of Water and Power or Anaheim Water and Power, any of these municipal-owned utilities that we have in Southern California. We're joined by the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo, who's proposing the model of a co-op that would be owned by customers in lieu of PG&E, which services San Jose. They recently went through this experience where thousands of their customers were without power for an extended period as part of PG&E's precautionary cuts of power because of high winds. Also with us, Michael Wara of Stanford University's Woods Institute for the Environment. He directs the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford. And John DeStasio, who is the president of the Large Public Power Council. He was the CEO of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District previously. Let me go back to you, Mayor Liccardo, and I'm sorry I had to so abruptly conclude that. So we're talking about the next step for this. If there's a protracted legal fight for the assets of PG&E, is this something that the city would really be up for?
Well, Larry, thanks. You know, we recognize there are really two venues where this would be fought out and perhaps a third. There's certainly the federal bankruptcy court, then there's the PUC, and it's quite possible the legislature may get involved. And I'm not going to predict how all that's going to sort out. What I'm hoping is that with enough cities and counties behind a cooperative model, that there might be some willingness, various stakeholders, to push in that direction. Obviously, we've got some hedge funds on the other side of that fight, but I have my confidence that the public could win.
All right. Let me go back to John DeStasio. John, what's your sense of how protracted a battle this might be?
Well, I think the mayor said it right. I mean, the experience that Sacramento had doesn't necessarily have to be the experience now, especially with the overhang of a bankruptcy proceeding. So there are different avenues now that probably change the dynamic of a city looking to either municipalize or stand up an electric co-op.
And Michael Wara, so how is the infrastructure repair going to be funded here? Because, you know, my understanding that the rate increases that were approved by the State Public Utilities Commission for PG&E don't provide a fund to really do the kind of infrastructural repairs, you know, to avoid fires necessary to do that quickly. So what, you know, what's the answer over the next few years? Is it just shutting down the power preemptively for a decade?
Well, Mayor Liccardo made a really important point, which is that if, you know, if the utility were to be either to become a cooperative or a municipally owned utility, that would lower the risk from the perspective of the markets that would need to supply capital to make these investments. And so they could be done more inexpensively than at present. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind. We want to finance this with a 30-year mortgage, not a payday loan, ultimately, in terms of the interest rate that we're paying. And we're in big trouble with that right now. But I think the question around, you know, what do we need to do now to avoid blackouts? How do we manage that problem? That we are looking at a period of protracted power cuts, just because we lack the skilled labor, and really the skilled labor isn't available anywhere in the country to do the kind of work that needs to be done to the PG&E system much more rapidly than that. And so what I would expect is that we're going to see these kinds of safety blackouts for the next several years, and that over time, they will gradually the impacts on customers will get smaller over time. But it's going to be a long-term process. This is not something we're going to be able to get out of immediately. And whether the utility is municipal or collective or investor-owned isn't really going to make much difference on that.
In terms of the high-skilled labor to go out and do this repair work on lines, how are people trained in that? I assume these are union jobs and well paid, but how do the people that do that get the skills to do it?
Well, I'm not an expert on training for linemen, but I know that there's a progression of skill sets, and it takes an enormous amount of skill to be up on those lines, moving wires around, changing the layout of the circuits, which is the sorts of things that need to happen. It's also the case that we need to develop even really new skill sets, to understand the right way to build a system to take account of wildfire in Northern California. That really hasn't been done before. There are other examples that we can look to. The example of San Diego, where San Diego Gas and Electric has spent about 12 years learning how to do this in their territory. But their territory is a lot smaller. It doesn't have as many trees. It's not as geographically diverse. And there are way fewer people that live in the high-risk areas than in Northern California.
Yeah, PG&E, one of the big problems, isn't it, that of just the territory it covers, I'm not talking customers, but the size of the company's footprint, it's got huge rural areas it has to deal with.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And, it serves an enormously diverse, both socioeconomically and geographically, territory. And so... managing the growing risk of fire, that's being driven by a lot of factors. And I think we need to all bear that in mind, right? Part of the reason that these fires are so dangerous is that there are lots of people living in dangerous parts of the state. And when there are people in a place, that means we have to have electricity wires in that place and in some form or other. And so, part of the challenge here is thinking about the other steps we can take that don't involve necessarily the electricity system to improve safety and safer ways to house Californians.
PG&E says a new round of power outages this week could put 500,000 Californians in the dark for days. The warning addressed residents in 15 counties, most in the Sierra foothills and the San Francisco Bay Area. That would, of course, include San Jose. It came less than 2 weeks after all the shutdowns shut off more than 1 million people throughout Central and Northern California, those for multiple days. Mayor Sam Liccardo of San Jose, how is your city preparing for potential precautionary shutoffs?
Well, we've invested a lot of time and energy in doing things like creating digital platforms that enable all of our emergency responders to understand exactly what's going on the ground in real time, using a crowdsourcing app so that way residents can tell us when their power is going out. We're often getting that information well in advance at PG&E, so then we can respond and really identifying in advance who those medically vulnerable residents are so we can get them to a safe place where they can get access to electricity for their respirators or wheelchairs.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you all for being with us. That's the mayor of San Jose, Sam Liccardo, who's proposed a co-op customer-owned utility that would take the place of PG&E, which provides power to Northern and Central California. Michael Wara of Stanford University, where he directs the Climate and Energy Policy Program, and John DeStasio, president of the Large Public Power Council, and he had previously headed up the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. These just the types of guests that we bring you every day, those right at the center of these sorts of public policy discussions that have a huge effect on you, whether you receive electricity, what you're paying for it, and the future of ownership of utilities.